Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. Now, a couple of times on the podcast, I've had two guests on or multiple guests on to discuss one book, but this time it's a little more balanced because I've got two guests and we're going to be talking about two books. The guests are Marshall and Steve from Androids and Assets, and we are going to be talking about the two books, Green Mars and Blue Mars by Kim Stanley Robinson, which were the winners of the 1994 and 1997 Hugo Awards for Best Novel. And we'll talk about why we want to talk about them all at once. But first, hi, guys.
Hello.
You've heard from me already. You
know? I have heard from you already.
I never know.
Yeah.
So now I can't go back and edit that out. So.
Oh, sorry.
Well done.
I'll take it again.
That's a veteran podcaster move. So for the few of my listeners who aren't already familiar with you guys, what are you all about? And maybe one of you should talk first and maybe somebody can talk second. So Marshall, why don't you go first?
When you say, what are we all about? Are you meaning like me as a person or, we as a podcast?
You know, I do want to hear both.
Okay. Me as a person, I'm a public servant and a trained economist. And I read a lot of science fiction. Compared to the general population, I read a lot of science fiction and fantasy. Compared to people who read science fiction, I'm like middle of the pack.
Gotcha.
In terms of reading. But, you know, this is my second time through the Mars trilogy, and they were my first introduction to Kim Stanley Robinson. So if that's where you start, and I think you make it through the trilogy, like you can read anything that he writes.
Okay.
That. It's just like there's no stopping you.
All right. Sounds good. And science fiction fandom for you, did that start with books? Did it start with other media?
I'm going to say yes to the books.
Okay.
Probably. I don't know. I mean, so like if we're talking speculative fiction as a whole, I bought The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe when I was in third grade at one of the Scholastic book fairs.
Oh, yeah.
Which is like one of my like core memories. And I just remember I've read science fiction and fantasy ever since. Still,
Marshall has left the building. Oh, here he's back.
Alien Stole My Body by Bruce Coville.
Bruce Coville, that takes me back.
I still have these on my shelf beside me.
Wow.
And that's like early young kid science fiction right there.
Yeah.
You know, Aliens Ate My Homework. So it was, books. But then, of course, like, there was like Cartoon X-Men on when I was a kid. So like that was a Saturday morning staple. But I think I started with books and I've just never stopped. I will still consume all sorts of science fiction media.
Nice. All right. What about you, Steve?
I also was, when I was in the third grade, I was in a 5-day in school suspension for fighting, and definitely read all of those Bruce. How do you pronounce his last name? Clovis.
Coville.
Bruce. Yeah, I read all of Bruce Coville's books during that week where I had to sit in a tiny desk in the hallway outside the principal's office, and definitely read all of those. So that was a very formative experience for me.
Nice. In an alternate universe, you don't get to read anything good and you just set off on a life of crime.
Yeah, then I become a jock and
to read in prison, right? So
join the infamous Yakuza, cut off my own fingertips. I'm also part of the Androids and Assets podcast with Marshall, and we like to talk about a very niche thing, the political economy of science fiction. We're not talking about science fiction in general. We're not talking about fantasy in general. No, specifically how decisions get made, how societies are organized, how wealth and resources are distributed. That's really our jam. We talk a lot about, and I think part of me, because like a lot of our love of history, a lot of our love of science fiction in our youth led to our decision for both of us to study history in university. And that's how we met, actually. So,
yeah, I was going to ask if you guys, you know, knew each other in real life or if you just, you know, encountered each other online and have been connecting over the vast spaces of Canada and recording podcasts. But it sounds like do you live fairly close to each other?
Yeah.
Okay.
Really close to each other.
But you don't actually record in person? Is that right?
We have recorded in person. And for the first, 3 years of our podcasting, we did. And then there was a pandemic and we
were
forbidden by law to be in the same room. So
I guess that was a factor, wasn't it?
But now that the convoy has granted us freedom from this authoritarian repression, we still stay home. Yeah.
So, Steve, you kind of gave us the idea of androids and assets. And this came out of discussions in college, or how did the podcast actually come to be?
I think we just wanted to do something like we were talking a lot about currency, specifically like gold and like why gold is used in fantasy. And, you know, and obviously that's for a bunch of like historical reasons, like largely, but, you know, how that also has a confluence with contemporary discussions. At the time, cryptocurrency was big, and you might've heard of it. and I think we were kind of talking about those sorts of concerns. So Marshall, do you remember it differently? I think we just mainly wanted to like do a podcast, and that was the kind of place we landed.
Yeah. We had been talking about like, let's start a band. and what could we do though? And we both read a lot of science fiction and we would talk about it a lot. So then it was like, well, it kind of makes sense for us to do that for other people.
And you kind of have a sub-series of the podcast talking about Deep Space Nine called Emissaries of Profit, which is awesome.
We do. It's a little bit on hiatus right now.
Okay.
There was a bit of podcast and life overfill. So scale back a bit, and Emissaries of Profit is sort of the victim of that. So it's, we haven't recorded one in a while, but
Deep Space Nine kind of lends itself to those conversations better than other Trek, I think, does, just because the economics and stuff are right there with Quark and the Federation and the Bajorans and everything.
They are it's absolutely perfect for what we talk about.
Yeah. So, like I mentioned, we're going to be talking about two books, the second two books in Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy, Green Mars and Blue Mars. What was it? I don't even remember how it came to be that this is what we were going to talk about, but I remember asking, can we just do both? Just because this is not a series that where each book really stands alone. Maybe I'm way off on that, but to me, like you could not drop yourself into Green Mars and have any idea what was going on.
No.
You know, at times I have jumped right into a book and not done a bunch of homework, but for these ones, Red Mars was one that I had struggled to get through a number of times. I'd tried it just because I had heard a lot of good things about it. I heard it was hard science fiction. I'm a bit of a techo. And so I thought it's going to be right up my alley and really, like I said, really struggled with it. And I don't know why exactly. I do know that I prefer my science fiction a little softer, even though I'm a techo. You know, that's work for me. And it's not what I like to do on my leisure time. So who wants to tackle the quick non-spoiler synopsis, if it's even possible? Did we draw straws?
I can do it.
Okay.
People go to Mars and they have a bunch of meetings there.
Accurate.
That's all I can do.
You know, you left out the one thing that I kept seeing in the Wikipedia entries, where it said like detailed descriptions of Mars.
Yeah, and there's a lot of geology. Yeah, a lot of geography and geography. And geology.
Yeah. Yes. I swear, if I had to read about an escarpment one more time, or the catabatic winds, I was like, okay, can we find
the regolith?
Yes, exactly.
There's only one type of wind on Mars.
I guess so. So in terms of, I mean, I think that's a fair description, right? That you could add the detail that in Red Mars, 100 colonists essentially descend on Mars and have disagreements about what the approach to colonization of Mars should be, which I would think would be the kind of thing you wanted to iron out beforehand. But we find out that basically everybody lied on all the assessments the entire time, which, you know, not unrealistic.
Yeah, 100 people go to Mars and have meetings there. Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah.
Well, they have meetings prior to getting there too, because that's what true. Red Mars is. Half that book is about that. Is this the first time for both? It's not the first time for both of you. Is it first time for either of you? Steve, have you read these before?
I read it when I was an idiot and did not understand it in the slightest.
Okay.
Because I was dumb. And 15. And I read it and appreciate it on a much deeper level.
Okay. And Marshall, you said these were a reread for you as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I read them, I think about 10 years ago.
Okay. And would you both say, I'll start one at a time. Steve, are these books that you like? You said you appreciated them more.
These are urgently important books that I believe everyone should read.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. I'll definitely want to pull on that thread. What about
that
you,
didn't answer the question.
I liked it. I liked them. Yes.
Okay. I mean, I definitely have like movies like Blade Runner that I'm like, I appreciate that movie. I'm not sure how much I like it, but I do appreciate it. What about you, Marshall?
I love these books. I love them so much.
Okay.
I hate reading them, but I love them.
Okay. That is a fine distinction, because I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say that there could scarcely be a book series more perfectly calibrated to not appeal to me. You know, like I said, really a struggle to get through Ed Mars. Did not have a moment's enjoyment reading that book. Then I got to Green Mars. I kind of like the stuff with Zygote and Nergal. And I was hoping that like the Nergal stuff with him being able to generate heat was going to be important somehow. I don't think it was. I think it was another just kind of non sequitur thread left out there. And then Blue Mars, I enjoyed that I was finally finished. And there was some of the stuff, like if there's any character that I kind of got behind a little bit, it was Sax Russell. And that was partially because of the stuff that he went through. And, you know, I'm kind of rooting for him to get over the torture that he was subjected to and trying to regain his ability to speak and that kind of stuff. So toward the end of Blue Mars, when he's trying to figure out, you know, how to undo the quick decline, I was kind of sort of rooting for him in there. But I think I can say that these books are probably brilliant. They're just not my thing. And so anybody listening to this, you know, you're not going to hear a bunch of great things from me on this one. And that's okay. Marshall and Steve are here. They've got you.
Yeah. I think like to read all of them, it's basically like a month to read each of these books for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because it just takes so long to get through. And I'm like, it's only 700 pages.
Right.
And if it was other books, I could read four 300 page books in the same amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
But these ones, they're so dense, and the descriptions, it's difficult to know when the descriptions are going to be important and relevant.
Yeah.
And when it's just like a ponderous description of Mars.
Yeah. On a reread, I mean, do you skim that kind of stuff?
I think I did a lot more skimming this time than the first time through.
Mm.
I read them like 15 years ago, so it was like basically a whole new book for me.
I mean, in terms of your life experience at that point, right? There's a lot of this that you could, did you maybe identify with Nergal a little bit and the Zygote people?
Yeah. I think that was more like my thing. Yeah. I definitely wanted to be like magical. Wanted them to have superpowers and that kind of stuff.
Gerontological treatments, is that how it's pronounced? That allows them. Yeah. And this is a thing, like, I will say there are brilliant things about the book. For instance, if you're going to write a series that's going to have to take place over hundreds of years, because that's how long terraforming takes, you have to find a way to either introduce new characters or make the characters last the entire time.
Or, in the case of these books, do both.
Yes, I was just about to say that. Because when you have a first 100, you can go, oh, suddenly there's this guy, Jeff, that we knew. That's not an actual name, but there were definitely times where I'm like, have we met that character before? Because I'm not sure we have.
Yeah.
He loved having names just to be able to just be like, oh, and then Ewow came and joined them. And I was like,
yeah.
Who?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
I feel like I have like the perfect like kind of like slice of this book example for why I understand why it's frustrating for a lot of readers, and also why I think it's also one of the things that really adds to it. But, you know, the concept that in like 1997, a white American man was using the term Shi'i like to describe like imams of the Shia faith of like 12 or Shiism is unparalleled in the English language discourse of the 90s. The notion that you had differentiated all Muslim peoples, let alone like, you know, like use very like specific terms to describe them is, again, like something that's really hard to find outside of like directly outside of Middle Eastern studies in that period. and it's, you know, it speaks to the level of detail that the KSR brings to this book, but there's such a profusion of that. like it's not just that, it's everything. Everything is so rich in its detail, and everything has so much, you know, attribution and pathos also, like,
right,
piled on top. So it becomes like, I understand why that's dense, and that's work. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of work.
And I'll say, in terms of hard science fiction, if you really like the nuts and bolts stuff, then, you know, this is a book series in which the mechanism of, like, I can't remember if it was an antidepressant or antipsychotic, the mechanism of how it does its thing in the brain was discussed in great detail. And I think that was in Red Mars. But that's this kind of book. To say nothing of, you know, all the processes for terraforming.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's like any time that something can be described in scientific language, it is. Like it's not enough just to take an antidepressant. It's like, and here's exactly what it did.
Right. So who might like this novel? What are some comps to this, if you can think of any?
I was going to say New York 2140, but that's not fair.
It's fair to crib from the same author.
I'd say like the Foundation series, mm-hmm, by Isaac Asimov, just in the sense that it's a long duration. Long journée, if you will, as we'll talk about this later. But, you know, like a story that covers a lot, like a long span of time, and kind of what happens to a civilization or a group, or in this case, a planet.
Yeah.
Longitudinally.
Yeah. Any other comps you can think of? Any, you know, if people are fans of, you know, I would say like a book like The Martian, right? It's hard science fiction, but it's a lot more, I'm going to say, engaging, and I'm not trying to insult these books. It's just, it's in that first person kind of perspective, that keeps you locked into this kind of quirky, funny character. And there's not a lot of that in these books.
No, yeah, I think that's,
Cause the Martian's written in it's first person narration, right? Like the titular Martian is telling you his experience.
He is. It does shift perspectives at some point, but all the versus parts that, like, are, yeah, from his perspective, are in first person.
Yeah. Versus like, and Red Mars is this like omniscient third person narrator, right?
Yeah.
And it's very like kind of impersonal and detached, and doesn't, and very few scenes in it contain a sort of kinetic things. Like, it's not like people aren't there doing stuff per se. Like, a lot of action happens. Like there are many, there are wars and battles,
yeah,
laced throughout this book. And at no point is anyone like gripping the joystick or like pulling the trigger. It's all like, and then they went and had a battle over there. You know,
yes.
Some missiles were launched, you know? Mm-hmm.
Okay. I will say that when the first space elevator was taken down, that was kind of exciting. And the people trying to survive by jumping out and kind of getting rescued by the improbability drive or something.
That's because then you actually have soldiers on the ground doing stuff, and Sax mm-hmm. is, that's with the masks, right? Sax has these machines that will help people breathe the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that the same? Oh my God.
I think it is. Yeah.
Oh no.
I think that's the second revolution though. I think Neal Stephenson, some of Neal Stephenson's work is also, if you enjoy him, you'll enjoy, you are more likely to enjoy, these books. I'm thinking like Seven Eves or...
I have not read either of those.
The Cryptonomicon.
Okay.
Where it's like, it's pretty detailed. They're both great, and I think you would hate them.
One comp that I kept thinking of was Atlas Shrugged. And again, it's going to sound like I'm insulting these books, and I'm not trying to. It's just, if you like long monologues about political theory by characters you probably despise, you're going to get those. Maybe you don't despise the characters.
You wound me.
Maybe you understand them, and that's fine.
The one thing I do want to say is that Mars is very non-polemical. I totally get what you're saying with the Atlas Shrugged thing, but but like Ayn Rand's definitely out to tell you like one thing, right? To convey an idea to you, and everyone serves that agenda. There is a lot of contradicting voices and ideas inside Mars.
I don't feel like KSR really takes a side.
No.
Between the reds and the greens. Okay, so let's go ahead and head over into spoiler talk, and also, you know, forgive me for insulting the book by comparing it to Rand.
I mean, you're right in a sense. It is. I mean, I'm the one who said it was people go to Mars and have meetings. that's not unfair. That's not an unfounded thing to say.
Okay. So in spoiler talk, we can talk about whatever we want to. This is where we can have the Androids and Assets mini episode within this episode. I have a few things that I wrote down, but some of it is just me griping.
Can I just try and give my best attempt at a brief survey of these books?
Yeah, please do.
So ostensibly, yes, 100 people are selected for an international mission to Mars. They go through a rigorous process. They go to Antarctica for some reason, largely because I think KSR went there once. They train, then they go, they all fly over there. It's kind of this, again, it's a post-Cold War milieu, so it's largely an American and Russian contingent with some other nationalities attached. They go over there. Yes, they found their first community. Is Underhill the first one?
I believe so.
Yeah, they found the first community of Underhill. They all get a lot of radiation. That's important. And they kind of begin making this first community there. Meanwhile, the situation on Earth continues to deteriorate. Like, again, like speaking of like the prescience of this book, like the issue of climate change is very at the forefront of what's happening on Earth during these books. Climate change is radically driving events on Earth in a way that, again, like most people in the 90s were not even willing to acknowledge, let alone describe.
Yeah.
So there begins to actually be immigration to Mars. And actually some of the first of these migrants are Arabs, Bedouin. They come and they kind of like, you know, kind of have this desert, these desert societies come and kind of found themselves on Mars and become like the earliest colonists to Mars after the first 100. The first 100, meanwhile, develop a longevity treatment because they're a community of scientists. They very quickly like realize a way to extend their lives. And this kind of becomes very important to the narrative conceit, as we've mentioned, that it enables this core group of 100 people to live a very long time. You know, they begin having children, and there begins to be fractures amongst the 100 and the settlers, you know, as they have sort of these political debates and ideas about what Mars should be. Should Mars stay the same, or should Mars be transformed? As time goes on, the terraform camp begins to come to kind of preeminence. As that's really kind of conducive to all of the commercial and political agendas back on Earth. You know, they get help. A company comes, there are all these companies on Earth that are now called Metanats, stands for Metanational. Like the idea that the companies have outgrown the countries. Like they're not just transnational, they're beyond nations. They have a peerage relationship with countries.
I think they're only transnational in Red Mars and they become Metas. Yeah.
But anyway, these big corporations come and they build a space elevator, and you know, and very quickly, like the core 100 are kind of losing control. The leader of the Mars, or what the kind of thought leader of Mars, is a guy called John Boone. John Boone was the kind of went. I believe he had been to Mars once before, right?
Yes.
There was like a forerunner mission. Yeah. He was the first man on Mars because there was a forerunner mission where they, like an Apollo type mission to Mars. And John Boone was in that one. And he kind of is like the big celebrity of the 100's journey to Mars. He becomes a big political leader. He takes a lot of drugs, a homebrew they have called Omega Dorf. He's a big fan of it. He starts seeing little red men everywhere. and he's got this like big vision for like a Mars. And that's kind of like spiritual and communal. This also is paired with like kind of like the radical agenda of one of the first 100, a Japanese woman named Hiroko, who I always want to call Haru for some reason, but it's Hiroko. but anyway, Hiroko kind of, and then they end up sort of like, so John Boone is like kind of having this political mission, while Hiroko is kind of starting this weird Mars-centric religion called Areophany.
Right.
And Areophany is sort of like, yeah, like this communal approach to Mars, living in conjunction and kind of extracting this spiritual, psycho-spiritual force of what they call Viriditas. Right. Marshall, can you think of a better way to describe Viriditas?
Viriditas is the force of life spreading throughout the universe and the galaxy. It's sort of an anti-entropy.
Yeah, so Viriditas is like action against disorder. Yeah. Anyway, but John Boone is killed. Hiroko is forced down, facing the onslaught of multinational and newcomers to Mars. The Reds, or the people who think Mars should kind of stay the same, blow up the space elevator at the end. That ends the first book. In the second book, terraforming is progressing. Zax Russell, I believe, who's we've talked about before, is like, he's kind of up more in the green camp. He gets his plan to start like throwing like comets into Mars's atmosphere. So they kind of burn up and start chemically changing the composition of Mars's atmosphere. There is a big, I forgot about the first Congress.
Is it in the first book? Is it in the first book? Yeah. when they're in a war when they blow up and the first 100 go into hiding?
They do end up in hiding.
I think that's a pretty important
point. You're right.
Is that like Terra basically takes it over and Mars becomes a police state more or less, and the first 100 are like on a wanted list, like not dead or alive, just preferably dead.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, and during this time, they also have like their first I forgot in Red Mars because they also have the first Congress, right? Is that in Red Mars? Yes. Yeah, they kind of found like, they're basically their Declaration of Independence, kind of.
Is that Dorsa Brevia?
Dorsa Brevia.
Yeah, the Dorsa Brevia document.
Yeah, the Dorsa Brevia document. Yeah, which is kind of like the basic things. Like, what?
It's
is
a very
Mars?
Radical statement.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, yes, and
like no private property.
I mean, you talked about Bogdanovists.
Yeah. Arcady.
My man.
That kind of goes back to like what I was talking about earlier, where like they literally get on the ship, and the moment they're out of Earth orbit, Arcady starts talking about how, hey, we need to throw out everything that the people who put this mission together want to do, and we need to make something entirely new.
Yeah, we're all poly-communists, right?
Right.
Right? You? Yeah? Cool. Yeah, and Hiroko's all, like, with Ariophany and everything.
I mean, like, I understand the desire, and I'm kind of derailing your recap, but, like, I understand the desire to form a more harmonious society, right? A more just society and all of that kind of discussion. But the thing that I had a hard time accepting was that people would go on this colonization mission not agreeing on how they should approach terraforming or if terraforming is even moral or ethical. I would have thought that would have been hammered out before they left.
And I was under the impression that it had been hammered out, that it was like, we're specifically going there to terraform.
Well, and I mean, like, there were different shades of red, right? Because you had Anne, who was very much she was the one who was like, no, we should make as little change as we need in order for us to be able to support a population here, but, you know, keep it cold, keep the atmosphere thin, all that kind of stuff. But then Hiroko, like you said, ends up going out and starting this cult in the desert. And that's a very different, she's kind of just wanting to be in harmony with Mars, and Anne is like, I just want to keep
and
Mars
then
cold.
And then Zax Russell, who says
we must make the planet our slave,
be, you know,
right?
Yeah, I want to make it warmer, faster.
Yeah, and I did enjoy some of the stuff about, you know, like the balance between, if we want to make it warmer, we need a thicker atmosphere. But if the atmosphere is too much carbon dioxide, then we have to get the carbon dioxide out. And so, you know, what's going to be the best way to do it? And maybe this is just like, and you guys can tell me if it's because of like my American imperialist background that I was like, well, yeah, of course you're going to terraform because we're going there to terraform Mars. And why would we want to preserve it? It's lifeless, essentially, as far as we know. But maybe that's why I got behind Zax Russell, because that was kind of his perspective. Although he did say that, you know, above a certain altitude, they were going to try and leave it as is. But how much can you really do that?
Yeah. I think one of the important things to note about Mars, for people who don't know a lot about like Mars geography, which is probably most people, is that everything's bigger on Mars, right? Just geologically speaking, like the tallest mountain in the solar system, Olympus Mons, is like dwarfs Mount Everest, right? The deepest canyon is like four times deeper than the Grand Canyon. There's just like everything is its features, its tectonic properties are kind of like further along. So it's just like, it's just wild and very different, and has some like kind of like natural treasures that are really without parallel. maybe in the universe.
Yeah. And so from that perspective, I guess, yeah, I can see the preservationist angle.
But anyway, I think, yes, if I blow by blow summarize this whole book, we'll be here forever. So the point is, yes, in Green Mars, that focuses more on the terraforming. And as kind of things move further and further along, it focuses a lot on the Hiroko's son, Nergal, who's part of this group called Ectogens, who are people who are like basically grown in tanks. They're science babies. It's cool.
Right.
And they kind of, and they've only known this like radical, and they've only known radical societies. Right. The Bogdanovists, kind of advance their political agenda and slowly begin to reestablish connections with Earth. And I think that kind of nothing, and they ultimately rebuild the space elevator.
Right. Right. And things go progressively worse and worse on Earth.
Yeah. Yeah. During Green Mars, also then this weird benevolent company called Praxis shows up. And Praxis is like, I think Praxis is a true metanational corporation. They're so big and so powerful. But Praxis is extremely like supportive of Mars and its radical element. They're just like, whatever you want. We don't want to exploit Mars. We want to just support Mars and be there for Mars.
Right.
Which is like, this is where I kind of be like, hard to believe, but okay. Yeah. So Praxis shows up and becomes a huge ally to Mars's nascent political structure, independent political structure. And then there begins to, again, be renewed tensions as things get worse and worse on Earth. Earth wants to dump more and more people onto Mars. This sets up everything for Blue Mars, where they're finally getting to the point where they're, you know, getting water together and stuff to actually make oceans, you know, and really make it like a much more Earth-like planet and destroy a lot of like the things that we associate with Mars irrevocably. And this culminates in ultimately like one last gas, a kind of constitutional congress. This again, a lot of Blue Mars is a lot of constitutional Congress meetings.
Yes.
Where people like sit down and, you know, people come from the Bogdanovists and the Areophanists, and, you know, and various Arabs and and so on come, and they, you know, they all have meetings and kind of decide on a constitution for Mars. And there's one last gasp effort for Earth to assert control. But by that point, like, Mars is so established, you know, that it can kind of like hegemonically absorb the military threat of Earth because like people are trending that way anyway. So, and they're coming and arriving and becoming part of Mars, and the project of Mars, cannot be so easily subdued without destroying the kind of last hope of so many desperate people back on Earth.
Right. Well, and even by this time, there's more missions, like extrasolar, right?
Yeah. They're also setting up, they're also building stuff on like Jupiter's moons. Like there's stuff going on in Ganymede and Europa. Yeah. And they're leaving.
Yeah. Mercury like, even.
Yeah. Yeah. I think actually at one point, like they said, the Martians have a prison call, have like an exile colony somewhere, right? Off planet. They're exiling people there. So.
Yeah. And I can't remember which book it was where they sent the delegation back to Earth. Was that in Blue Mars?
Yes, that's in Blue Mars.
Okay. Okay, we're Nergal, and I can't remember who else goes back. And this is one of the problems, right? You kind of need a list of characters to keep track of what's going on, and a couple maps. And so for this, I was listening to the audiobook, and I thought, boy, if I had a map and a list of characters, it would really be helpful.
Yeah. There is a list of characters. So if you are trying to read this, Kim Stanley Robinson's website has a list of characters, which is very helpful. If you're not sure who Jackie is...
I do know who Jackie is, but between Nadia and Maria, I'm not sure.
That's fair. They're tough to pull apart. Yeah, so they're both in the 100, right? Nadia and Maria. Yeah,
yeah. Only you never get like just the one name. It's always Maria. I can't remember it now. Toitovna.
Maya. Not Maria.
Maya. That's right. Maya. Not Maya.
I was like, because there's a Marina.
Nadia.
Right. Yeah. And this is one of the problems. If you have 100 characters, you know, and how are you going to keep them apart?
You can't. You absolutely cannot.
It's really only like 13 of the first. Yeah. And really, it's 101.
Right, because of Kaede. We never mentioned because of the stowaway.
Who's a stowaway of Hiroko. Yeah, mm-hmm. And also called that for his penchant for making caches. So,
right.
He likes to dig holes and leave stuff in them.
Yeah. And, you know, by the time you get into Blue Mars, you have that like the tribes of ferals who, I guess, just kind of move around like hunter-gatherers.
Yeah, they got their rovers, their trucks.
Yep. And
pickup truck society.
Yeah, yeah. Another thing that Kim Stanley Robinson really thought that we would have in this great future on Mars is orgies. Lots of orgies.
there are so many.
He did the Nietzschean transvaluation of all values and the Dionysian one out over the Apollonian discourse.
Wow.
Those were some words. Nobody knows what that means.
Come on. In the world of apophatic discourse. Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry. But yes. Yeah. One of the big things. Yes. I now know what tabling is.
Right. Whether you wanted to or not.
Oh, my God. I had forgotten what tabling was.
Yep. And that's pretty late in Blue Mars when that comes in. You're like, oh, so this is a thing. Okay. Yeah. Everybody goes to a pool and has a big sex party around one person.
Who wants to swim in that pool?
Got some serious chlorine in there.
So sexual mores are certainly challenged. This is a huge bone of contention, actually, because one of the natural allies of the Reds is actually the Arabs, who are like from, you know, who kind of view Mars as like a desert and kind of have like a, you know, a relationship with it. And but so as much as they're kind of natural allies ecologically, they're difference of opinion in sexual mores become a flashpoint of conflict between them, which I think is interesting.
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, Hiroko went off to wherever she went to and made a bunch of babies, right? I won't say had a bunch of babies because like you said, they're like in uterine replicators from the Vorkosigan saga. But pretty much, you know, with a variety of fathers. So Nergal, I think, is Coyote's son, right?
Hiroko and Coyote. Desmond,
yes. It's his actual name.
How annoying was it that he switched back and forth with that name?
Pretty annoying, yeah. The
made me crazy.
Gerontological treatments, like I said, it's a great way to keep your characters alive long enough. And it gives a bit of a conflict there when you realize with population pressure, the longer people live, you know, that's going to be a problem. And it's mentioned the like Malthusian, hyper-Malthusian situation where that's a reference to Thomas Malthus. I know that much. Is it Thomas Malthus? Do I know that much?
I think you're right.
Overpopulation fears, right? I did think it was interesting when there was essentially like carbon credits for human beings, where it's like a 1.5 babies per couple.
I mean, that was never actually instituted, right?
No,
that
was just a proposal.
Arts gaming of it, which was hilarious.
Yeah. I mean, like to get the gerontological treatment, though, you do have to receive a birth control like implant, right? Yeah. So you can't
on Earth.
Yeah. On Earth. Yes. Never on Mars. But Mars doesn't have the same problem.
Yeah. And it was very much, you know, true to the real world that when you have this kind of treatment, it's going to be the kind of thing that the rich definitely have access to.
Yeah. There's longevity as class struggle issues.
Mm-hmm.
All over the place.
Yeah.
And never mind that now they're having new novel health problems. Like one of the big problems is that the people who have been doing it for a long time begin to have brain stuff, right? Because the brain's not meant to have grasp a life that long.
Yeah. And, you know, the first kind of indication of that is they start realizing that their memories don't go back very far. And it makes me wonder if, you know, living hundreds of years but losing your memories, it doesn't seem like a good trade.
Well, they say that explicitly toward the end of Blue Mars, that like if our minds fail,
still you?
What good is, like, you're not even living anymore.
The brain of Theseus.
And it's not, so I'll definitively say that just in case anybody didn't know.
Marshall settled the question.
He did. Yeah. Okay. Cause late in Blue Mars, Sax Russell is kind of trying to figure out the quick decline, right? Or is that what it's called? And comes up with a cocktail of drugs to restore all memories. And it takes it right back to the events of Red Mars in their memories, reliving the assassination of
even further.
Yeah, even further.
Immediately after they take the cocktail, And it's Sax's memory.
Right.
He remembers being born.
Boo.
Which I thought was hilarious.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd be a fan of that.
I mean, like, there's an issue with the fact that, like, you probably can't see when you're born. Right. So you could remember it, but it wouldn't mean anything to you because you're basically blind. Because yeah. You don't have the...
Well, sight is not your only sensation.
That's true, I guess. But it'd be hard to know that what you were experiencing, like, I feel pressure and wet and then loud. Like, I don't know. Like, yeah.
And yeah, pain.
Like, I don't know. I imagine people may... I think people might remember their birth, but if they do, they don't... It doesn't mean anything to them.
Right.
I don't know.
There's whole schools of, you know, philosophy
yeah.
and... It doesn't repressed matter. Memories Neither and that kind of stuff
there.
That
yeah there is yes there is a whole thing about birth trauma and all that stuff
right
is,
birth trauma
I don't know it, irrelevant not germane to what we're discussing
right so you know what is it earlier when you were talking I can't remember which one of it was said something like you know these are very important books I think it was you Steve and I know that Marshall you said something about how these are great books that you don't like reading but you know you're glad that you have essentially. So what is it about these that really kind of raises them up in your estimation that way?
One of my big things about this book is the fact that it's actually like, it's a fiction book, but it's actually history.
Right? Sure.
So, yeah. So it's tricking you to read a historical narrative and it's kind of, I think in some ways teaching people to engage with historical textualism and think mm-hmm. about things in the perspective of history. And I think one thing that's really cool about this is it's almost like, and what makes it a really unique novel, I think it's a science fiction narrative that in many ways conforms to the conventions of the French historical school called the Annales. So there was this historical movement in the 1920s in France called the Annales. It was founded by Lucien Lefebvre and Marbleau and others, but they kind of focused on this thing that they called two things. One thing they called the longue durée, which is this concept like history doesn't just happen in like, you know, the life of a king or like a battle or a war. History happens in large spans of time, and things that happened 100 years ago affect things that happen in the present or, you know, down that far 100 years on, right? Mm-hmm. And that one of the big things is that there was not just a relationship of person to person, but of people to geography and to mm-hmm. the ecology that they existed in, right? So Lucien Lefebvre's very famous book, like The Mediterranean and Its People in the Life of Philip II, which is, you know, talks about how changes in the Mediterranean coastline and changes in watersheds drove political and social change. Inside that period, and you gotta remember, this is the 1920s, right? This is much before like we had like, you know, a broad sense of like deep ecology or any of those kinds of movements or ways of thinking about these things. So this is interesting because it is very much written in like the Annales style. It's an Annales history, except with, you know, with a cast of 100 immortal characters kind of lacing throughout it and creating like, you know, plots and personal dramas that can move things along. So it's not suffering from the thing that Lefebvre's books suffer from, which is being very, very boring. And I don't know why I call them Lefebvre because it's just Fevre. I don't know. Like, I think I'm in the... I feel so bad. Lucien Fevre. Yeah. Like,
because it's French.
I apologize for... You know, it's cool. And so I think it's like, it's teaching people to engage seriously with stuff and to think about it deeper, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a... I think, you know, it can trick you, right? Not a lot of people are going to be like, oh, well, maybe I can read a... You know, like let's think deeply about the relationship between, you know, our ecology and our political... our situation. Most people might not seek that out. And if they did, they'd actually have a hard time doing it because that's a very academic discourse and it's very difficult to access. But anyone can pick up a science fiction book about Mars, you know?
Right. And of course, you're not reading about geology, you're reading about areology.
Yes, I apologize.
KSR is very, very committed to, I think even, he went areosynchronous orbit, right? Instead of geosynchronous.
Yeah. It's not, the Earth.
There was even like APS instead of GPS. And I thought the G was just global, but so it could still work. It didn't stand for Gaia. Maybe Gaia globe comes from that somehow. Yeah, exactly.
that's what we navigate by meditating.
Yeah. It's interesting when you kind of put this book in and compare it to a history, because thinking about the history of colonialism, right, and just thinking about North America, and you know the different moves for independence, you can look at that. And maybe this goes back to my American imperialist upbringing. When they land there on Mars and then they're starting to think about independence, you know, I'm 100% for that. I'm like, well, that makes sense. Why wouldn't it be that way? Why wouldn't you have gone to create that? Why wouldn't that have been the purpose? And of course, the reason is because the people who sent them are expecting a profit out of it in some way. And Mars being independent doesn't necessarily lend itself to that.
No, certainly not.
Yeah, I think, and this is where you also hit on my great criticism of these books, like in the sense they have a flaw. So one of the big things about like European naval power, you know, and settlement of Europeans into North America and Africa and Asia, is there's this thing about like, oftentimes these colonies were a sort of penal colony, right? Like often you sent your fuck ups there. Right, your second sons, your religious fundamentalist weirdos, and you ship them off, right? And then they went and they fought with each other in the colonies, and thank God you didn't. And then they sent you money back, and you don't have to deal with it anymore, right? And I think the fact that you talk about like, oh, they send these 100 extremely highly trained and disciplined people, and they immediately turn to thoughts of insurrection and radical transformation, doesn't follow. And you're right. It doesn't follow, right? Then this notion that just going somewhere different makes people radical. I think that that's actually like that's a significant problem, because you're right. In truth, these people would be very dedicated. They're people of caste and position in their societies. They have, they don't have this default affinity with their enemies and with their neighbors, you know? So, yeah, I think you're right. That's actually not something that follows from this book. Okay. It's a piece of wishful thinking that sets everything into motion.
I don't think I agree with your characterization of that though, because they are 100 highly trained, skilled scientists, but they're also being offered a trip to a place that is one way for the rest of their life, right? And some of them sort of realize that along the way, it's like, oh yeah, they're sending us here to make money, but I went here to do science, and I don't want to be directed how to do that science. I want to do the best science I can do. That's why I left Earth, because if I'm on a lab that they control, I do the science that they want me to do. But if I'm on Mars and I have my own lab, I do the science that I feel like doing, that I'm capable of doing when I feel like doing it. And they can't actually control me anymore.
Yeah. Okay.
And they live a very communal life.
Yeah. Out of necessity.
But then I think once people live a communal life, even if it is out of necessity, they kind of go, why would I go back? Right. The grind is not something that people enjoy. We don't call it the grind because it's fun.
No, your point is well, I accept your correction. Wholeheartedly. I think you're right. There is a lot of those coercion.
So they are weirdos from the very beginning. Yeah, they are weirdos. And they are the people who f***ed up on Earth, because they're like, I don't want that. And if you don't fit in the society you're in, that's why religious fundamentalists got kicked out of Europe, because they didn't fit anymore. And these radical scientists didn't fit on Earth anymore. And so they lied about it and said, yeah, we want to recreate Earth up there and we'll send you all the precious metals, don't worry. And they lied about it and got sent up there. And then Arcady immediately was like, ha ha, all right, so we all lied, right?
Except for Michelle, right, the psychologist.
Who didn't have to lie, but was forced to be there anyway. And there are a couple poor of Michelle. Earnest people there, right? Like Phyllis, I really enjoyed Phyllis as a character, because it was so easy to hate her.
Isn't she Phyllis, one who got Sax Russell tortured?
Yes, she is.
Yeah. Because she's kind she's of the, in the pocket of the... Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. She's one of the United Nations affiliated...
Right.
You know.
Collaborator.
She ran the space elevator and was on it the first time when they fired it off into space, and they were like, finally, we're rid of Phyllis. And then she came back and they're like, God,
like a bad penny.
Somebody needs to throw a grenade at her.
Well, and there's the whole subplot, I think, in Green Mars, where Sax Russell goes undercover.
Yes.
And like gets plastic mm-hmm. surgery. Like it's the whole Jason Bourne thing, only he's not particularly adept at spycraft. And you know, they end up hooking up, and I don't even remember how his cover gets blown. Is it because they're hooking up?
Yeah, it's because they're hooking up. Phyllis makes yeah. him.
No, yeah. she doesn't even notice yeah. and the while Swiss... they're hooking up. It's when they fell in a crevasse right. on a walk, and she went, wait a minute, I remember this situation happening before, and you're behaving very yeah. much like Sax. And then
she hands him over.
And, you yeah. know, not all of the battle scenes and that kind of stuff were super exciting to me. They were kind of described in a textbook like fashion, but the raid to retrieve Sax was actually pretty
yeah
pretty compelling. Yeah.
There are a couple of times that it feels like Kim Stanley Robinson is like, okay, fine, like I will break down into a bit of an action sequence for you. I don't like this. It's not what I'm writing these books for. But
fine,
like,
they're on a catamaran.
I'll give you this one. you can have this one, but you definitely know that like. Those scenes of battle and of war are not what he could describe them in very great detail, and you would know exactly what type of gun they're using
yes.
and how it was powered and who invented it and what modifications were made and everything, the airspeed of a bullet in Mars and the ballistics of it and will it reach the horizon right. before it hits the ground and all of that. I don't know.
This is a good time. Might be a good time to talk about hydrogen peroxide. The 102nd sure, character of the this is the 100 and Desmond the Coyote and hydrogen peroxide
and Kava Java. Don't forget Kava Java.
Yeah, Kava Java. Yeah. Kava's
and the
is Kava hallucinogen. Yeah. The Sufis. The Sufis in there. Kava Java.
Yeah.
But yes. I think it's very. I think yes. Because there is like speaking of this and like they're like. The atmospheric chemistry and like all the problems you run into Mars, like the kind of example of like why he's clever is like, of course, because Mars has very little oxygen, no one's out there burning a combustion engine.
Right.
Right. You're not driving around your car on gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they need to power their vehicles with something that can combust, for lack of a better word. I don't know if it's actually combustion in the case, but something, you know, something you can burn in the right. high carbon dioxide atmosphere of Mars. And that is hydrogen peroxide, right? So they can burn it. It's a fun fact. Hydrogen peroxide is the fuel that the U.S. military uses in its cruise missiles. Cruise missiles are hydrogen peroxide powered. Yeah. I found this very interesting. That's not here now. But yeah, so hydrogen peroxide is what they use for fuel, and they want it because, you know, as you use it up, it contributes things that they want in the atmosphere, such as oxygen and hydrogen, right?
Right.
Giving them over to the atmosphere. So it kind of ends up being used as a currency.
Yes, definitely.
Right? They start trading in units of hydrogen peroxide, and this has like one of the reasons they settle on this also is because from, you know, the second you synthesize hydrogen peroxide, you're slowly losing it. Right. Mm-hmm. It's gradually breaking apart. So you can't hoard it and keep it forever. It automatically is depreciating. You know, you don't need it to depreciate in value because it's always kind of being eaten at by the atmosphere.
Right.
And of course, you also want to use it. You want to drive your rover. You want to power stuff. You want to get things. So it's very, it's an interest. It's almost the... And Marshall, you can speak more to this. It's almost the inverse of metalism, right? You want gold because it lasts forever and its value is always going to go up and you can hoard it. Whereas like this is like this notion that you want to give it away.
It's ethereal in some sense.
Yeah.
What do you think about that, Marshall?
I mean, yeah, like it. I did enjoy that they were when people had a bunch of hydrogen peroxide, they would try to give it to somebody else.
I don't want your hydrogen.
And the whole gift yeah. economy that was going on was very funny to me when it was like, well, let me give you some hydrogen peroxide for your car. And they're like, don't saddle me with this hydrogen peroxide. Like now I have to, oh my God, like I have to burn some of it and I have to just like use some of it. And now you've given me this big gift
and nicer I have to gift.
Make up for it.
Right.
And they'd be like, no, 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 it's okay. I have more hydrogen peroxide. I'll burn 10 kilos for every kilo I give you so that we're even. And you're just like, this makes no sense to follow.
Yeah, well, it's interesting.
But I love all of it.
It's also interesting because this was maybe the first time where I started to appreciate a little bit better about like what was meant by potlatching, because one of the big things. Coyote and Nergal are having that discussion, right? Where they're doing the gift economy thing. They're talking about the burning the hydrogen, and then they're trying to unload some uranium that's in a truck somewhere,
right?
Everything runs on nuclear power, which is the other reason I love this book. Everything's got a nuclear reactor behind it. Nothing functions without them. Anyway, yeah, they kind of talk about potlatching, which is where people like try to give too much, right? And with there's this idea that yes, you want to give more. Like the way you win in the gift economy is by giving more than the other person. But if you just overgive and like create this like bidding war and cause people to like imperil their situation, then you've engaged in potlatching and kind of how this was like, and this was like a real thing that happened in terms of like, you know, like Europeans stimulating like these indigenous gift economies around the world, the Salish in, you know, the Pacific coast of North America, as an example, right? Like, or what we call North America, you know, that they would come into these gift economies and they would kind of bait them to overspend and put themselves into a marginal position materially. And you learn about it in school, but I didn't really like, it's so dumb. Like, I mean, dumb and bad really in respects that I had to like see it like played out like quantitatively. Someone had to like list the numbers for me to kind of figure out what that was.
And how because a potlatch
is very interesting
in the indigenous way of doing it. It was that you would invite a bunch of people over, and then you would feed them all. It would be like a big feast, and you would give stuff away or you would destroy things that were valuable to show people just how rich you were. Like, I can give away all of this because I'm so rich. And so it was,
it's a way of achieving status. Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
And then there's potlatch warfare when people do that to their detriment. Like, yeah. Here, take my kid's college fund. Take the last of the food I have.
I had completely forgotten about the hydrogen peroxide economy.
We got to talk about it. Androids and Assets has to talk about the hydrogen peroxide economy.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, I like the hydrogen peroxide economy, and I like the gift economy, and I like the eco-economics where they're trying to figure out sort of like the caloric value of a life. And like, you know, smaller organisms have less because, they're smaller and you need to eat a bunch of them before you can survive. That was all great. And I think it was a part of like the larger thing that KSR was doing in these books. And what I like about them and why I love these books, even though they are often very hard to read, and separating out what's going to be important from what is just sort of a, it seems like a thing that he thought of at one point and was like, I'll just put that in the book. Like Nurgle being able to generate heat. Yeah. And then maybe he loses that ability later in life or something. I don't know. Cause it stops getting mentioned after he saves Sax's life. It's just sort of like, and then Nurgle never did it ever again. So sorting that out and sort of sifting through it and finding like what's good and what's not, or what's important and what's not is tricky. Unless you just like hearing descriptions of Mars and people, in which case, you know, great. But when I read these, it's like it's not necessarily like a blueprint, but like a rough guide or a thought experiment about how can we have a place that is completely separate from Earth and make a new way of living that is completely separate from what we know now. And you really need to have somewhere that you can be separate because, pardon me, the behemoth of capitalism and colonialism is such that unless you can separate yourself from it almost entirely and ideally entirely, it's going to drag you back in. And we see that all the time in the world that we're in, right? We talk about like, oh, there's these communist countries, but really none of them are separate enough to actually engage in the economic system that they say they're engaging in, because colonialism and capitalism says no and forces them to stay in the world. So this is him saying like, if we had something separate and different, how could the world be? And it turns out that world can be really sweet, right? Mars is a pretty freaking cool place to be. Aside from like the low gravity and the bird suit.
That's exactly what I was going to talk about. Like, I mean, how awesome is that? And I did like, I really liked that part, I was just like, what are we even talking about here? What is the point of this? But I did think it sounded awesome.
Just because it was cool.
To have these Waldo-assisted flight suits that you could pretty much indefinitely soar around because the combination of the atmosphere being thick enough and gravity being light enough that...
humans could fly for real.
It sounds awesome.
It was amazing. Mm-hmm. But even more amazing to me was worker-owned co-ops and being able to just sort of direct your own life according to your interests at any time. And being able to sort of like pick up those interests and be like, you know, I've done this for long enough. I want to do something different and not be told you can't do anything different because you're an expert in a single thing and your entire worth is based on doing that one thing. And if you want to change, that's fine, but you're going to be poor. Right,
you'll be punished.
You're going to lose your house. You're probably not going to be able to eat well anymore. And don't even think about going to see a movie.
Right. Or you could do that for... 40 years of your healthy life and then retire and hope that you have enough stamina to do the things that you've been wanting to do the
right
whole time.
My
wife and I were just out in the Wallawas in eastern northeastern Oregon. Beautiful place. We ran into this lady who had said that she and her husband had planned to come there after he retired and he died. And
oh,
so,
no. Shit.
So she was out there basically, doing the travel that they'd wanted to do together. But that's like my wife and I and our son are planning a trip to Iceland, this summer because we're like, you know what? We're relatively healthy right now and, we can do it. So let's go now and not wait until we're 65.
And that is heartbreaking.
Yeah, it is. It's like, terrible. And you hear that kind of story all the time.
Always. So often.
Yeah. I did think it was interesting that, Sax Russell at some point is just like, I'm going to drive across the entire globe. And
just because I can.
Yeah, just because I can, like you were saying, right? Because it's not like there's something else that he had to be doing right there. And, he's doing science by doing that, right? A survey. Yeah. But he runs into all kinds of trouble. And this brings up one of the questions that I have. He insists that he saw Heroku. Heroku. And when he gets the enhanced memory, that memory is enhanced as well. That doesn't necessarily mean it was really true, but there's sightings of her all over the solar system. And I kind of wanted the question answered definitively by the book. Is she real or is it just, she has become this kind of wandering messianic figure?
Yeah. She is merged with Veritas.
Ah, there it is.
Yeah.
Yeah,
So when they get to Barnard Star or wherever they were going, they're going to find her there too.
Yeah.
She'll be Aslan.
Still mentioning it. She'll be Aslan. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think with that he's making very much like a, I joked earlier about apophatic discourse and the Dionysian and the Apollonian, but I really do think Nietzsche is very present in these books, and that this sort of like the Heroku does represent this like will to power in much more like the Nietzschean sense of, like the, in much more I think the sense Nietzsche intended and not as this like fascizoid super soldier but more as this like erudite transcendental life giver type figure and that is sort of the will to power a journey that Heroku goes on and so naturally we culminate in her, transcendence into Veritas itself.
I like that idea. Okay. I got one of my questions answered.
I was really, really hoping that, she would just show up, in Underhill, in the end of Blue and take the memory treatment with the rest of them. And they'd all be real pissed at her. And she'd be like, yeah, that's whatever.
I did think it was not cool at all that Sax forced Anne, to take the treatments. Basically when she was incapacitated. I thought that's not cool.
Yeah, not cool. And I think also then troubling that later she's thankful that he did.
Yeah. And it's one of the first 100 and she stops taking the longevity treatment.
Not that so that's
Sax Russell finds her and forces her to take it.
Yeah.
Right. Basically where she is unable to make medical decisions herself and he basically overrides her explicit instructions. So it's an exploitation that I can't really justify. And the book kind of does, like you said.
Oh, it wholeheartedly does. And I think, it's one of those times where I'm sort of like, I get what you're saying there, KSR, that like it was an irrational choice on her part to stop taking the treatments and to say, don't revive me, when there's clearly medical facilities available that could extend your life. And why wouldn't you? There's no, you know, it's not the same as extending a life now when it's like, well, they're going to be in a vegetative state or a coma or whatever until they die. It was like, no, she could come back and live a healthy life. Why would you not do that? But she chose not to.
She chose not to. And, you know, bodily autonomy, unfortunately, is extremely in the news these days.
Yeah. Yeah. If somebody says, I don't want this, then okay, great. I don't need to understand your choice.
Yeah. Respect that decision. It.
Yeah. It's bad.
Other things. What else would we normally talk about on an episode of Androids and Assets about these books?
I think we got to talk about a lot of this is about, really, it's two political conferences in three books.
Yes.
And, you know, and this idea that this the book talks a lot about how you make how you do political coalitions and how you forge these consensuses, I guess, amongst these political groups, and that, you know, like you do negotiate, but and also with an awareness that you do these negotiations and you cut these deals, but you also do have to exert power and coercion. Right. But that the exertion of power and coercion is tactful, right? And has to be done with a larger view, and has to be, you need to carrots and sticks, you know, that you have to provide people incentives and penalties, and you have to like work these things in a broad political system to generate, the structures of governance and, you know, and group cohesion that you need to do stuff like provide services to people, like deliver, you know, deliver governance and security and provision, right? That these things all have to flow from that process. And which is nice, because often when people...
They do that maybe at some point, but the first conference, the Dorsa Brevia conference, is like entirely not that.
Yeah, because, you know, you start with the like the thinking and the dreaming, right?
Yeah.
And then you know,
but still coalition building.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the hammer comes and the fucking hammer comes down on you, and you need to build, you know, you actually need to start having.
So what's the hammer?
Hegemony. The hammer is Terra, right? People are there like trying to think about what Mars could be, and, you know, and the Metanats and Earth, you know, come down and say, no, we're not having any of this. Right.
Right.
And like, I think that's a process, but so you need to have ideology, and you need to have doctrine. And then at a certain point, then you also need to have you need to be concrete about it then in its implementation. Right. And you certainly can't come in and steamroll everyone with your ideology. Like this is Bogdanov's thought, and we have to, you know, can't come in there and like, well, listen, we gotta do something about these car dealerships because of, you know, socialist doctrine,
but
because of Marxist Leninism.
So Dorsa Brevia happens, and and they have this like very radical idea about how they could live. And this is still in the police state. It's sort of a dangerous thing for them to do.
But yeah.
They have this conference, and then they have a document. After that, though, I thought a lot of the work was like Nurgle and others having reading groups and giving talks and just community building in general.
Yeah, right? they go out in this
police state, and to overthrow it, it wasn't just a revolution. It was making sure that like everybody who was on Mars agreed at least mostly in principle with the idea of a free Mars without Earth tyranny. And and like people were explicitly coming to Mars to escape these things, being like, yeah, I'm going to go join the outback. Like I'm going to land. And then as soon as I can get out somewhere far enough away from my handlers, I'm going to get out of here. I want to be a part of that cool movement.
Yeah.
So,
and creating a viable alternative. Yeah.
So before even having to hammer things out and establish a system of governance, it was, let's get people like excited and interested in this idea and disgusted at the way that Earth was doing things, right?
Yes.
And I liked that. I liked the idea of just like, you get to go out and talk to people and just have a wide-ranging discussion about what should Mars be. And here's a document. What do you think of it? You think you could live with this? Like, let's do it. And then when governing came, when it finally came time to govern, and they had their revolution where they were able to sort of like force the Earth police forces out, or at least into one small area, because they were just so overwhelmed. The governance part of it was very hard, and having that global conference was very hard to like nail down a system, an actual system of governance. And then doing it was very hard. Like, Nadia just had a very difficult time like being the first president, and was like, oh God, this is the worst job ever.
It really was.
Oh my God. Yeah, it was. But at least she got to regrow her finger.
Yeah.
So
what is Kim Stanley Robinson saying about democracy with Blue Mars? Because I fear that there's sort of like a
misreading.
Not a misreading of it, but he seems to talk a lot about like the dangers of democracy. Because in Blue, eventually like Mars, Free Mars and Mars First take over and get a supermajority, and then they pack the courts, and then it's like they kind of get to a point where they're like they're forcing a war with Terra, and they're violating the Constitution, and they're breaking the law, and they do it because that's what happens. And when you go to the capital, which I think the capital was Mangala, eventually, like you go there and you just become corrupt by this power. And sure, we elect you, but there's always some people who are more interested in getting elected. And because there's a lot of scientists that don't want to get elected, those people are able to sort of get into positions of power and then abuse it and use it. And then eventually you have end up with this, no matter what, a corrupt government. And then they needed whoever remained of the first 100 to like come in and be like, no, we're done with this. You guys have fucked up too much, and we're overthrowing you, and we're redoing this. And it was like, just get some rational people in there. Get those scientists back. Get the adults in the room, and we can.
Yes. Yeah, I think you're right about that. And that's a bugbear for him. And it's, I think this really is going to play out a lot when we later on this year talk about Ministry of the Future. I think that, you know, yes, we need the adults in the room, if we have the smart people in charge.
If only.
And there's something that he has about like entrenched interests.
I think that's a real problem.
Right? Because even in New York 2140, he's like, if we just have the people, right, it's the people's interest we need to be looking out for. And if the people could just do this directly, then we'd be way better off. But as soon as you get people elected, somebody's going to be buying them off somehow, in some way.
Well, I mean, he's right there in the sense that all political power flows from constituency, right? Like you know,
gun.
No, that's stupid. Because you can't. I mean, if you're doing with that gun is creating a constituency, constituency can flow. No, but you know, you have to. There's interests you represent as a politician always, right? And so I think like it is correct, and I think it's something that like Lenin understood this very brilliantly, and he was like, listen, all political institutions need a constituency, and they only give a fuck about their constituency, right? Because those are the people they have to serve to stay in power. What if I just want my constituency to be the majority of the people, and anyone who's not in that represented in that large, you know, in the working class, you know, my constituency group can get bent, you know, and this led to a lot of problems, obviously. But, you know, I think like it was a smart move, right? It's what enabled the Bolsheviks to defeat the Mensheviks and the other revolutionary parties. Right? It was that their acute understanding of that. And I think that's true and that's right. You know, and I mean, then also like then other ideas like, you know, like ideas of setting up like councils and things like, what's the workers' co-ops you talked about, like a Madragon in Spain, right? Basque worker cooperative, worker socialism. They have just a large number of worker-owned companies, and they perform very well, and their salaries are very good, and it's like a good, it's a nice system. And like it's that, so I think, and KSR is really captivated with that, and the idea of like by people building power, you know, people by building power in their workplaces and in their communities. kind of gives them control and enables them then to participate in the, gives them something with which to participate in the political process with, because they actually have some power, some realized power. I think working people always have power, but it's often not organized and realized.
What was it about the, you know, like you mentioned, there's the two councils, and there's kind of the mini one right at the end of Blue Mars that's just like, hey, let's, can't we all just get along? Where the 100 come in and are like, nope, we're not going back to war. It's not going to happen. There's the vote of no confidence for Jackie. I think she ends up taking a colony ship.
Yeah, Jackie had already taken her colony ship.
Cooler heads prevail.
I'm not even sure if we knew who was in charge of government at that point.
No. But I just feel like it's, you know, it's kind of a fundamentally optimistic, the idea that eventually they would figure it out on Mars and wouldn't just recapitulate everything we've seen on Earth.
You think it was optimistic?
I don't know. I mean, like,
because it felt like they needed somebody to, like, that they hadn't figured it out. Or at least maybe only some people had figured it out. The original 100 had figured it out.
Yeah, and I guess that's a good point. Maybe it's the wisdom of years combined with the actual, you know, ability to remember everything. I mean, you know, there's the well-worn statement, right, that doomed to repeat it if you can't remember it, right? Those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. And if you have hundreds of years of memories, maybe you can forestall some of the mistakes.
I think it's very salient. That one of the things that one of the biggest, like, history is a major contention in politics, right?
Yeah.
Like every ruler comes to their decisions often with a historical justification.
Right.
Right. Like either, you know, like today I was listening to some right wing person and they were harping on like fear of decline and replicating the mistakes of the Roman Empire in America. And I was like, wow, that's really interesting. Like that's an interesting and kind of like weirdly that's a wild historical take and a very common one, right? But those, like, there's no understanding of conditions in the Roman Empire in the third century, you know,
right?
At all in any of that, no one knows anything about that. But they talk about it, you know, and all they think about is like, I don't know what they're worried about, like. I mean, the way this person was talking, it sounded like they were tilting at like concerns about homosexuality, you know, and you know, people not working enough or something, which are kind of like the two things that get bandied about in the discourse. Because I think there's that parochial saying about how at the end the Roman Empire had more holidays than working days, right? You know, which is like, I don't know if that's true or not. I also don't know a lot about that, but I think it's very interesting that people are like, you know, trying to make cases for why America should look a certain way because of conditions in the Roman Empire in the third century.
Sure. Yeah.
It's wild. Well, that's wild to me. Third and fourth century. And wild, y'all.
If we could actually tap the directors, or no, the drafters of the U.S. Constitution, right, we could get their actual opinions on, hey, that whole Second Amendment thing, does this apply to semi-automatic rifles? It would be nice to be able to tap that wisdom. You'd think we should be able to figure it out, but we evidently can't.
Hey, Abe. I guess the Second Amendment was, the Second Amendment was the drafter, the framers. Yeah, I mean, we'd probably be horrified by what they had to say.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure they're right?
We'd be very deeply upset.
I think we'd also be surprised a lot of times, too, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's always the statement that, you know, like science advances one funeral at a time, you know, because the old guard has their orthodoxy that they cling to. And then, you know, when they're pushed aside, then the new group of hippies can come in and take us in a different direction that everybody's been blind to this whole time. So like the idea of having people be longer lived would mean that there would be a slower pace like that.
Yeah, it would probably contribute to net conservatism in society.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think they talk about that at length, right? And this is also part of the importance of the neuroplasticity treatments that everyone has, like, that all the people with longevity treatment have, like, every once in a while, like a little mini puberty where they, like, their mind, or their, right?
Yeah, blank out.
They kind of become young again. Yeah.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. The people have, because they have, in order to maintain their brains, they need to get the neuroplasticity treatment periodically. And that does kind of stop them from ossifying as people, like in their worldview.
Yeah.
He also, I mean, the author has a deep love of the scientific method and a very,
yes.
Yeah.
He's very confident in it. And we see that with Sax Russell when Sax wants to learn a new science. And he just starts reading about it, finding some surveys and finding somebody who's written some, you know, approachable material, which then allows him to get enough of a basic understanding to start reading the journals. And then once you've done that, you can approach the experts. And then within some amount of time, you can be on the forefront of science, which is theoretically and ideally. Well,
that's assuming a world without the material constraints on your research process.
But
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So base determines superstructure.
Exactly.
Yeah. If he had to be seeking funding for his research, that would have been different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Vastly different. And to be able to just kind of drop everything and devote yourself to the research of whatever.
But I mean, at the end of the day, I think this is a book that is deeply concerned with truth. Mm-hmm. And coming back to what I said initially about it, about like there is an urgency and an importance in this book, I think it is because particularly in our current circumstance, truth is so fraught.
Yes.
Right. There's so many people talking and everyone's clamoring for your attention. Everyone's clamoring to tell you something and finding out things for yourself and understanding and knowing where to put yourself and your energies is such a desperate struggle. But this book asks you to engage with truth and asks you to think about truth and gives you a bunch of people clamoring for your attention, all with dire urgency. And granted, all of these people are much more intelligent than everyone on social media, but myself included, but all of these voices are very intelligent and erudite. And, you know, I think it's good. It's like, I feel like it trains you to engage in truth and these things. May I read something really quick?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so I mentioned Mark Bloch. He was one of the contributors to the Annal School, and he wrote a book called The Historian's Craft, and he never finished it because he died. He was killed by the Nazis. He was a Jewish man, and he was killed by the Nazis during World War II. And this is the last paragraph of The Historian's Craft, and conceivably the last thing he ever wrote, because he was like writing it apparently like when they got him. So he's talking about like an opaque historical debate in French, like a historical theory in French history. We won't go into it. But anyway, speaking of this theory, the error was in considering this hypothesis as given at the outset. It needs to be proven. Then, once this proof, which we have no right to consider as unfeasible out of prejudice, has been supplied, it still remains for us by digging deeper into that analysis, to ask why, out of all the imaginable psychological attitudes, these particular ones should have imposed themselves upon the group. For as soon as we admit that a mental or emotional reaction is not self-explanatory, we are forced, in turn, whenever such a reaction occurs, to make a real effort to discover the reason for it. In a word, in history as elsewhere, the cause cannot be assumed. They are to be looked for.
It's good stuff. And yeah, like you said, that's kind of what this book does by presenting it as a history.
Yeah. And asking you to challenge your assumptions about
Well, and you know, there's importance to like the idea of presumably if we don't wipe ourselves out, right, we will go out into the solar system and think about creating other colonies of human beings on other planets. And it's important to think about what systems do we use to do that? And, you know, what is the actual goal? So this is, I feel like he's done some of the homework for those future people.
Well, I think he's done a lot of the homework for.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he's done a lot of the work for us now to say, what system should we be living in that might have a chance of sending people out to another planet?
To forestall us basically ending up like Earth in these books.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, that's the thing about science fiction, right? It's not necessarily talking about the future. It's talking about now.
Yeah, and that we have to hold central our relationship to our ecology, right? And that, like, you know, like, for example, like if our current view of economy, of political economy, of how we make decisions and how we distribute stuff does not account for carbon, the amount of carbon in or leaving the atmosphere, you have failed. You have failed. Right? Like, and this is, I think, the thing he talks about. We fuck your gross domestic product. You should be talking about your gross carbon product, right? Mm. Or some sort of relation thereof, right? I mean, I'm not saying we still need to think about human flourishing and we still need, people need to eat, you know, often we're, you know, and if we just do this slapdash and half-assed, we will create massive famine and huge destruction upon the earth, which is kind of what we're headed towards, right? So we gotta think differently, and we have to think about our ecology and our atmosphere much more centrally than we have.
Definitely.
And this book is, again, really good about that, and good about it in a time when no one was talking about that.
Yeah. Anything else we want to talk about these books? We've been going a while, and, you know, it makes sense when talking about a massive book series. And of course, we haven't really restricted ourselves to just talking about green and blue, because we're talking about the whole series.
How can you?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. It is one massive book.
I would like to talk to someone who's from like a society that's undergone a political revolution about these books, like a Cuban or an Iranian, you know, or like someone from the People's Republic of China. Like I would really like to have a conversation with them about these books. Like, so what do you think about these books? Cause I'd be very curious what they would have to say. Cause I think political revolution is like a huge part of these books, but it takes a very effusive and long ranging tact of them, which I think is the best way to view them and understand them. Because if you get too focused on like certain events or certain key days, you miss a lot. But I'd be curious what they would have to say or think about these books.
I think these books would be better if it was just Sax Russell the
whole time. He's such a bastard and you love him. Yeah.
No, I mean, again, as soon as I finish one of these books, I'm like, damn, that was a good book. But while I'm reading it, I'm just like, oh my God.
Right.
How is this still happening? And I love them. One of the things that I think Kim Stanley Robinson does a lot of, at least it comes up in other books as well, are the inserts between chapters, whether they're diegetic or non-diegetic, I think is debatable.
We did debate that.
But I really dislike these sections about Big Man and Paul Bunyan,
right?
And
right,
the little red people, and just like, stop it, skip this section, please. Thank you. Done. We don't need it. It's not good. It's not enjoyable. It doesn't add anything. And they're long enough as it is.
All right. Well, you want to know something? I liked those parts.
Those were your favorite parts.
It broke up the monotony a little for me. So I kind of liked those. Although the first time one of them happened, I can't remember where I was. I think I was driving. I was like, did I start the wrong book? So
Paul Bunyan.
Yeah.
The one where the little red men meet up with the Dalai Lama and talk about like peace and brotherhood for all mankind forever or whatever. That was a rough one for me. That got an eye roll or two. Like, you're hitting the Omega Dwarf a little too hard there.
Right. All right. Well, guys, thank you so much for doing this. We've been planning it for quite some time. I appreciate you being patient and kind of, when I was like, can we maybe do this next month, not this month? While I was trying to get through these. But I really appreciate your perspectives and your conversation. I was very happy to host an episode of your podcast.
We're happy to do one for you.
Very happy to be here.
So guys, before we sign off, where can people find you? Marshall, why don't you go first?
For myself, I'm on Twitter at EconoBoyd, but I don't really do much. I don't engage much on social media. You can find our show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Asset Droid. But again, we're bad at social media, so you can follow us, but you may as well just like put us in your podcatcher of choice, because really all we tweet about for the most part is there's a new episode out, and you can get that information other ways.
What about you, Steve?
Yeah, no, I mean, I am your go-to for crypto grind set, unlocking your potential. No, I'm joking. If you want more communist propaganda in your feed, you should follow my Twitter at Steve Droids. But really, that's all I'm good for. It's just like occasionally being like, something's happening in China or Vietnam or something.
Nice. Well, cool. I'll make sure to put all your links into the show notes. So thank you guys again for doing this, and I'm sure we'll talk down the line.
Sounds good.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Marshall and Steve. I thought they brought a lot of interesting things to the table, and I do want to apologize to people who love these books that they're not ones that I really enjoyed at all. But that's the nice thing about this podcast is I have guests on, and sometimes when I don't have the enthusiasm, my guests bring it. So I thought they did a great job. Make sure to check out their links in the show notes. Of course, if you enjoy this podcast and you want to support it in any way, you can follow on social media at Hugo's Podcast. Retweet the episodes, share them with your friends, leave a review for the podcast in your favorite podcatcher. And if you'd like to support it financially, you can go to patreon.com/Hugo's Podcast and sign up to support there. I think I only have two titles left that are unclaimed. And so once I have names for those ones, I will have the rest of the podcast planned out and scheduled. So if you want to grab one of those last two titles, they're both Robert Heinlein. So Farmer in the Sky or Beyond This Horizon are the two left. So if you want to grab them, now is the time. And as I'm recording this, Hugo voting has begun. So I'm going to start working on scheduling some group discussions about the short stories, maybe the novelettes. If I'm really ambitious, maybe the novellas, we'll see. So if you want to be in on those, make sure to reach out to me. I will put something out on social media as well. And if you've been on one before, I will reach out to you. So don't worry about that. But that'll be fun. Okay, I think that'll do it for this time. Thank you so much for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.